Okay, so thanks very much to KITP for having me for a whole month for this SFINA workshop and putting up with me. And thanks a lot for including me in this this conference. This is the first time I've been to a string vacuum project meeting. And so I actually wasn't sure how much overlap there would be in the audience between in this audience and the people who are here for this F-theory focus week, which I think I'm one of the only people who really works a lot on F-theory who was not here for the F-theory focus week, so I feel very bad about that. But anyway, I thought what I would do is, you know, with you know, my friends Natalia and Sakura, well, Sakura's here, we've sort of followed a very particular path in trying to construct and understand the types of F-theory models that you can get. And, you know, we think this path is very natural and it leads to a very, you know, specific sort of set of type of model. But I thought it would be helpful to sort of, you know, describe how we followed this path. Basically, what all of the assumptions that were made in order to lead us to the endpoint that we ultimately, you know, got to in the end. And that way you can understand, well, when you get to the end and you see the kind of model in F-theory that you have, if you're of the opinion that maybe you're standing at the end of a gangplank or something, then you can go back and ask, you know, at what points when you're going along this path can you sort of, what are the branch points where you can sort of deviate? In other words, sort of what are sort of the loopholes? So we tried to see what kind of theories come very naturally out of F-theory with some very sort of simple naturalness assumptions, but at various stages, you know, you could have in principle done something else, and I want to sort of tell the, just go into storytelling mode and describe sort of where we went, why we went there, and in a way where the logic is clear enough that, that you can see exactly where you could have done something differently. So if the I'm not going to talk so much about details of monogamies and all this stuff. People in the audience, many of them have heard me prattle on about this before. So I just want to make sure, you know, tell some sort of logical coherent story. And if anything's not clear about the logic, please, you know, stop me. So first, I have to ask this question, you know, how can we hope to say anything about particle physics and string vacuum are very complicated, lots of stuff is going on. How do we know what's affecting particle physics and so on? And people have been thinking, in this room have been thinking about this a lot longer than I have. But one thing that gives me comfort is this old story of unification of couplings, which seems to suggest that at some scale that's not quite the Planck scale, you specify supersymmetric gauge theory, and there's pretty good evidence that supersymmetric gauge theory is pretty much controlling everything that's going on at lower scales, all the way down to the, you know, hopefully the TEV scale where the LHC will find supersymmetry. So I think this is a very promising picture because we really just need to learn about what's going on with this gauge theory, and once we've done that, then, you know, that's the, you know, the input that we need. And, well, the question is, you know, how do we do that? And this leads to the standard bottom-up approach that everybody's sort of familiar with, which is most easily described in type 2 models with brains because the charged degrees of freedom are open strings localized on brains, and we can separate sort of the physics due to the geometry near the brain and the physics of some, you know, and what's going on in the closed string modes that, that explore the entire bulk. And there's sort of two classes of type 2 models with brains, one involving smooth compactifications where you wrap brains and intersect them, and that's the type of model we'll be talking about in this talk. But of course, that's not the only thing you can do. You can already start with a type 2 compactification that's singular, throw some brains probing those singularities, and that'll give you some nice quiver theories. And in fact, there are lots of ways to get things that look like the standard model. There's a huge literature on it from quiver constructions, but I won't be talking about this kind of thing in this talk. So, just to remind, just to remind you, when you're talking about intersecting brain models, you have some gauge group living on some brains, let's say maybe SU5 unified group, charged matter comes from open strings with one end on the stack. The other end has to end somewhere, maybe a D-brain, maybe some orientable plane so it can end on some image or something. But there has to be something corresponding to like a matter brain. And this local picture we know very well can be described at least in a local coordinate patch by starting with some larger rank gauge theory. In this example where you have five D brains, then another D brain coming in, you can describe it by an SU6 gauge theory with some adjoint VEV. And what the adjoint VEV is telling you is how the flavor brain has been rotated off of all of the rest. So really, you shouldn't be thinking about SU5 gauge theory with some charged matter, but the charged matter is really coming to you by virtue of some higher rank gauge theory. And the question is, what type of gauge theories are allowed? Well, the gauge theory should have some gauge group G that contains SU5 and non-trivial VEV or some adjoint scalar field that breaks that gauge theory from down to SU5 and maybe some abelian factors. One has to be careful that you know, this gauge theory interpretation has some limitations already. Large brain rotations, you know, if you lurch at a brain by a lot, have sort of string scale VEV, correspond to turning on string scale VEVs. But still, this type of picture is still useful to compute holomorphic data like the spectrum and the superpotential. By the way, the reason we always start with, you know, some SU5 unbroken is basically because we don't, you know, a single stack model as opposed to a multi-stack model is because a multi-stack model would correspond to the string scale VEVs breaking SU5, and this is in conflict, naturally in conflict with the you know, sort of unification picture that I'm always starting with. So the question is what gauge groups are allowed. Well, what are we shooting for? And of course, I always put this silly slide up that everybody knows. You know, this is what we're looking for, tens and five bars and so on. And we really want the superpotential. And we always ask, you know, how you get the superpotential is really up to you. But we'd like to impose some requirement that you can get the superpotential already at sort of tree level in this world volume gauge theory. So you don't need any non-perturbative effects to get it. Now, I mean, it is possible that these things could be generated by some kind of non-perturbative effects, but that would lead to some sort of large difference in the sizes of these couplings that maybe we don't want. So it's a possibility, but here's an assumption. These both come at tree level in the world volume gauge theory. So then you can just ask which gauge groups are possible. And, well, you start with some larger gauge group G that you've broken with SU5 across some abelian factors with a non-trivial Higgs VEV. Well, you'll get the joint of SU5, some abelian factors, and some bifundamentals. And the idea is to put the MSSM matter fields, 10 and 5 bar, and realize them as coming from the bifundamentals of this larger gauge group. Now, if you want to get this superpotential from, you know, for the sort of tree level of this world volume gauge theory, then these couplings have to descend from the superpotential of the world volume gauge theory. So in other words, they have to come from the adjoint of G cubed. And it's just a group theory question. If you get 10 and 5 bar from bifundamentals in this way, and you want both these couplings to sit inside adjoint of G cubed, then this group has to contain E7. And this is just a group theoretic way of saying that we're forced to study the non-perturbative realm of type 2 theories. I mean, this is something we're all very familiar with. It's the common arguments used to, you know, go to F theory and M theory. It's often said in terms of needing E6 enhancement points and blah blah. And I just want to say, you know, make clear, it's just really a group theory statement that if we think of some underlying higher dimensional gauge theory as sort of controlling everything, then the gauge group of that theory should be containing something like E7, which we really can't describe in perturbative strings. So we have two choices basically. One of these choices is M-theory, of course, and M-theory is sort of, in a sense, to think of M-theory compactifications on G2 manifolds as describing intersecting six-brain models. From the gauge theory perspective, what we have some stack of SU5 brains. You can think of a stack of 5D6 brains wrapping a three-cycle. And so the world volume gauge theory on them, you think of as a seven-dimensional gauge theory on a real three-manifold. And the approach to studying M-theory models from this perspective, to my knowledge, the only paper that really tries to do it, at least lay the groundwork for it, is the one by Penfield and Weinhold from April of last year. Charge matter is localized at points in this X3, so it's intrinsically four-dimensional, and we should hear at this conference by Constantine and Piusz, and maybe also Gordy, I'm not sure, about a framework for moduli stabilization in G2 manifolds and Suzy breaking that has all sorts of phenomenological predictions. The other choice that we have is F-theory, which is basically intersecting seven-brain models. And there, the gut gauge group is something that is something that lives on D7 brains wrapping a four-cycle. So we think of starting with an eight-dimensional gauge theory on a complex surface. Charge matter is localized on curves. And there are some, the nice thing about these models is there are some proposed mechanisms for flavor structure. Although the flavor models you may have heard about in F-theory, there's a few issues with them. There's a natural, the proposal by Heckman and Vaffa gives a natural way to get a hierarchical structure. But there's a question about what sets the size of this hierarchical structure. Fernando Marchesano, who I don't know is here, would say, for instance, that the hierarchies are generated by non-perturbative effects, and so very, very small, much smaller than the 10 to the minus 2, 10 to the minus 3 that we normally think of. I actually think there's a way to do it, but I'd be happy to talk about it later. But the generic situation is it comes on curves. Yeah, so we can discuss this. Right. So from the point of view of what I'm interested in, which is basically studying the charge sector of the theory, by which I mean the fields that carry non-trivial SU5 charge, and really getting a handle on engineering the MSSM, the MSSM superpotential, and avoiding problems like proton decay and so on, it's important to really understand these gauge theories. And from this perspective, F theory models have received a lot more attention. Now, some of the reasons given for that, that I hear from various people, are related to this flavor structure and the fact that there isn't a corresponding nice model of flavor on the M3 side, even though people like Jake Bourgeli, for example, have been thinking about it. But I suspect that another reason that the gauge theory and the F theory side has received a lot more attention is this reason, and that is just, it's just plain simpler to study. Understanding gauge theory on a complex surface is much easier than understanding gauge theory on a real three manifold. Over here, we have complex algebraic geometry to help us construct Higgs bundles and so on, whereas over here, the tools just aren't as powerful, so it's more difficult. But it's something that probably should be studied. Okay, so in this talk, we're interested in Gotz and F theory, which I want to think of roughly as corresponding to eight-dimensional E8 gauge theory on a complex surface in the presence of a non-trivial Higgs non-trivial expectation value for an adjoint scalar field. And just from this perspective, see how much progress one can make towards breaking the gut group, addressing proton decay issues, and addressing unification issues. And all the time, we should keep in the back of our minds that there are some limitations to the gauge theory perspective, but these limitations are something you just need to remember. And see how they modify what you're talking about. And Tyson and his collaborators had a nice paper talking about some important aspects of that last week, 2 weeks ago. I've been here too long. Basically, yeah, you're just studying, but the gauge theory is basically telling you there's a dictionary relating the gauge theory, the Higgs bundle of the gauge theory to the local geometry, and so there's questions about the things. Basically, what these guys talked about, for example, is there's this monogamy group that's inherent in the Higgs bundle, and there's a question of whether globally that monogamy group is increased. So you have fewer symmetries around the control of things than you thought. There are other things like this hypercharged flux condition lifting the hypercharged gauge boson, which comes from the fact that the world volume gauge fields coupled are our axions, which go outside. And the spectrum of those axions depends on details of the compactification. Those are the two things I have in mind. So just a quick aside about the connection to heterotic. Heterotic theory has been extremely useful in understanding how to build F-theory models, and this dates back to the beginning of F-theory, Morrison, Waffa, Fried, Morgenwitten. I think everything I'm talking about this slide was really understood almost like 11, 12 years ago by Curiel and Donaghy, but it was very much clarified by Donaghy, Weinholt, and Tyson and his collaborators. And it is basically the statement I just said, and that is, there's three perspectives one can take. There's the gauge theory perspective, which is where you have a gauge theory with some Higgs, some Higgs field, and there's some data that specifies that Higgs field. And then there's the local geometry in F theory. And the data of that Higgs field is in one-to-one correspondence with data that specifies the local geometry of your F theory compactification near where the gauge degrees of freedom localize. And then that same data also specify structures on the heterotic side, because of course when you have a local K3 fibration, you can always throw it into a global K3 fibration. The charge degrees of freedom don't care which case you're in. So data from the heterotic side should also be telling you about that local geometry. And all of this is, there's this object called the spectral cover which is underlying all of this. And the point I want to make is that all the data that goes into this gauge theory description is actually data that comes to us directly from the heterotic string. And almost everything that we do in building F-theory models is carried over essentially from the heterotic string. So there are a few differences like this hypercharge flux, but basically everything we do comes from heterotic. And it's been very important for understanding some subtle details of F-theory models, particularly these authors did a great job with this, that we would otherwise have not understood. Okay, so now with that aside, we'll start seeing how much progress we can make with this stuff. And just remind you that in F-theory models, because you're talking about intersecting seven brains, charge matters localized on curves. So it's effectively six-dimensional, which means the spectrum of 4D multiplets requires a dimensional reduction. And the number of zero modes that you get can be adjusted basically with world volume fluxes. Essentially, the number of zero modes on a curve is the number of units of flux that zero mode couples, or that mode couples to, that threads the curve, roughly speaking. So to the extent that you can tune fluxes, you can adjust the spectrum on a given curve. Now, the common gut-breaking technique is to use this internal hypercharge flux on the complex surface, which breaks SU5 down. And the zero-mode counting in the presence of this hypercharge flux allows you to get rid of these annoying lepto quarks. It allows you to lift Higgs triplets. When this first came out, it seemed like a miracle. It seemed like, doing everything you wanted, take care of all the problems you had, and, it was almost seemed like it was for free. Unfortunately, it's not for free. But at the time, it seemed like it was kind of for free. So we adopt this as a method of breaking the gut gauge group. And the next problem you might have is dimension 4 proton decay. And of course, the dangerous operator is this guy. And as I understand, the bounds on this guy are really, really tight. So we really, really have to make sure this guy is just completely absent in the theory. And, you know, if you want to kill this guy, there are essentially two ways to do it. One is by using discrete symmetries. This is difficult in practice, although I should say that that is my opinion entirely. I think Tyson has a slightly different opinion. But engineering models with discrete symmetries is a technical challenge that has not really, I mean, the only serious attempt at it that I know in the context of F3 guts was in this paper, and they didn't get anything near the right matter spectrum or anything. So this is an open problem and a place where you could go off, you know, away from the path that we're following. We follow the path of trying to use continuous symmetries because you sort of have them already. You don't need to put them in. They're already there. You have some underlying structure of E8. When you break to SU5, you have abelian factors floating around, so why not take advantage of them? We should use them if they're there. So before we figure, try to ask, can we engineer U1 symmetries to protect us, we should ask, well, what symmetries do we want to shoot for? Well, it's well known that the MSSM superpotential, assuming these are not family symmetries, and this is for flavor reasons I'll review in a moment, the MSSM superpotential up to a rescaling of charges preserves a one-parameter family of U1s, which is just this one. And these go by sort of different names. When Q is equal to 0, this is just a combination of hypercharge and B minus L, so we call this B minus L models. And when Q is not equal to 0, we'll call this a PQ symmetry for sort of antiquated reasons. I'm not saying anything about strong CP problems, so don't think it's, you know, having anything to do with that. It's just sort of a notation for, you know, two different kinds of symmetries. And either one of those is sufficient to get rid of dimension 4 problems. But there are also bounds in the operator responsible for dimension 5 proton decay, which is this one. And in the past, mechanisms like missing partner have been proposed in the context of F-theory. And the idea there is that in this offending diagram, you just make, you know, there are, you need something to propagate inside. Typically, what propagates inside are Higgs triplets. And if you just find a way to remove this quadratic coupling between the Higgs triplets by making them partner up with somebody else, then you're OK, and you can save yourself. But unfortunately, F-theory models have KK modes everywhere. And these KK modes, if you arrange a situation where Higgs triplets don't propagate in this diagram, there will invariably be some Kaluza-Klein modes that do, unless you have a symmetry that tells you otherwise. So in fact, this operator is always generated unless it's prevented by some kind of symmetry. Now, this is an obvious statement in retrospect, but, you know, whatever. I mean, pardon? KK scale should be something less than the gut scale, but not so much less than the gut scale. One or two orders of magnitude. It's actually quite bad if the mass that comes in here is the KK scale, since these triplets, if I understand it, need to be sitting actually several orders of magnitude higher than the gut scale. Yeah, you remember that there's a 1 over M's, you know, this, yeah. So this operator carries a charge under our U1 symmetry, which is Q. So if Q is equal to 0, it's allowed. And that's just the statement people are familiar with, that B minus L doesn't forbid it. So if we want to expressly forbid this guy, we need to realize a U1 symmetry with Q not equal to 0. So we need one of these guys that I call the PQ symmetry. Now, if you want, you could also try to get around this problem. You know, bounds on dimension 5 are not as bad as bounds on dimension 4. So you could try to do some kind of tuning. You could find some way to, you know, tune these Yukawa couplings or something with that, you know, between the MSSM fields and KK modes that propagate in the diagram. And by that kind of tuning, you could try to reduce the tension here. You know, you need a factor of 10, extra factors of 10 to the minus 2 or 3, I think, in these couplings to really be successful. And we don't really have any understanding of how to do that in general. So we proceed by saying, well, the safest thing is to just forbid this operator entirely, which means we need a PQ symmetry. So here's another place where you could branch off. Some tuning here may save you from dimension 5. So maybe make some other comments on PQ symmetries and why they're nice. They prevent a bare mu term, which is a nice thing, generically. Some PQ charge field X carries a Susie breaking BEV, then you can generate a small mu term by Giudice Masiero. And this gives you a possible solution for the mu B mu problem that we learned about from Ibe and Catano and wrote about in the context of F theory about a couple years ago. And further, the PQ gauge boson, if there exists one, and it becomes massive, gives additional contributions to Susie breaking soft masses. This leads to some particular phenomenology that we'll hear about from Jing Xiao in a couple of days, if such a gauge boson exists, of course. So what we want to do is we want to engineer the MSSM with some generations, and we've seen we really want to engineer this PQ symmetry. So how do we do it? Well, our U1s come from the parent gauge group, which is this SU5 God cross SU5 perp. And SU5 perp has a cartan, which is U1 to the fourth. And we turn on some Higgs-Vev in this SU5 perp to break down to SU5 God. And that Higgs-Vev can be written just as an SU5 matrix, where these TIs have to sum to zero, of course. And this phi adjoint will vary over the internal space, which means these TIs vary over the internal space. But as they do that, only gauge invariant quantities, such as, you know, traces of polynomials of this guy, or symmetric polynomials of the TIs have to be well-defined. The individual TIs themselves do not have to be well-defined. As you move around the loop in the internal space, it's quite fine if two or more of these TIs mix under a Weyl group transformation of SU5 perp. So in general, these TIs will be permuted by some monodromy group as we move along the internal space. And what the monodromy group is related to exactly what Higgs bundle we turned on. What Higgs field configuration did we turn on? So this monodromy group effectively quotients the theory. And when it does that, it removes generically most, or actually in general, generically all of the U1s. So this G monodromy is intrinsically connected to the global structure of the Higgs bundle on the internal surface. So if you want to keep one of these U1s, you have to carefully engineer your Higgs field so that the monodromy group is not generic. It's something non-generic that leaves one of these U1s not projected out. So what you want to do then is build F-theory models so that some U1 subgroup of SU5 perp remains and is able to play the role of a PQ symmetry. And the question is, can we do that? And hopefully you've seen why we're moved to doing this. And well, the answer is that the Rossi scenario described here doesn't seem to like PQ symmetries very much, unfortunately. And in particular, you can show that if you have a PQ symmetry, as well as two other simple things. One is all three generations of standard model matter living on this, being zero modes on a single curve. And this is a prerequisite for the flavor structure models of Heckman and Vafa. That's where this assumption comes from. And the second is gut breaking with a hypercharged flux, which is this magic mechanism that we all really liked in the beginning. If you assume these two things and you try to engineer a PQ symmetry, you always get extra light non-gut exotic fields, by which I mean you get light fields that don't come in complete gut multiplets. They are vector-like with respect to the MSSM, but they carry charge under this PQ symmetry that forbids a large mass term for these guys. Yeah, I think it's a theorem. I would state it as a theorem.
Are they vector-like?
They're not. Which is why we know that they're the light. When they get massive, it'll be associated with whatever thing is breaking the PQ. Yeah, I would say it's at the level of a theorem right now, by now. There's one other hidden assumption here, and that's the underlying structure of the EA of cage theory. I'll get to going around that in a moment. So PQ symmetry implies exotic particles, and I've learned in the past that maybe calling these things exotics is not the best thing to do. It makes people think of, you know, pirates and gangplanks and things like this, and that's just not a very fun thing. But I don't know what else to call them. They're charged fields that we don't have in the MSSM, so anything like that, I call an exotic field. So what can we do about them? Well, the way we can get around this is false. We can find some other way to get flavor structure. And there were some papers about this. In fact, Fonten and Bunyas's paper came out before the Heckman and Vafa proposal, and it was basically, the idea was to spread MSSM matter fields on matter curves in sort of a way that doesn't respect gut multiplets, but so that everything sums to complete gut multiplets. And if you could get a good flavor model out of this scenario, you could avoid everything we're saying about exotics. You could use some other mechanism to break the gut group other than hypercharge flux. And as we'll see, there are many reasons to not like hypercharge flux, I think. So if you can use something else, maybe Wilson line, something like this, incorporated from a heterotic string, for example, then that would allow all of these things to, you know, allow us to avoid all of these things. You could look for exotic structures in string theory beyond E8, and this is something that was pointed out to us by the Harvard group, to make sure that I stress that. They came to us and said, why are you, you know, focusing on E8? Maybe you can realize this sort of E8 structure in something bigger. The loophole is basically in this E8 gauge theory picture, we turn on this Higgs field. This Higgs field is not finite everywhere. It has divergences. It's meromorphic and has poles. In fact, that's the loophole that allowed Tyson to show that the monodromy group can be larger than we think it is from the gauge theory perspective. But it may also give you room for some structure beyond E8. I don't know. Or you could just bite your tongue and say, okay, shoot, we came this far, we're stuck with exotic fields, and try to lift them. And the only way we know how to lift them, since they're carrying PQ charge, is to couple them to a PQ charge singlet. And I remark here that this is reminiscent of gauge mediation, just to, so you don't feel so horribly about these exotics, because if I told you these were gauge messenger fields that I introduced, and I introduced a scalar x, and I turned on this coupling for gauge mediation, nobody would care that these fields are not part of the MSSM, because they're playing a role and they're doing something important. You could take the idea of turning this into a gauge mediation model seriously. Maybe it has interesting phenomenology, but I won't talk about that. You could try to keep.
Is it impossible that have quantum numbers corresponding to complete SC5 multiplication?
Yeah, the whole point is they come, the numbers of fields that you get come. Basically, these guys, the ones you're forced to have, come from the 10. And there's three SU5 multiplets in the 10. And the relative numbers of each of these different component SU5 or standard model multiplets in the 10 is fixed. It's basically n plus 1, and n plus 2. So they're always in non-gut multiplets. So if they're sitting anywhere near the TEV scale, unification is out the window. And then why am I studying gut models?
Oops.
They are non-chiral with respect to the standard model gauge, which is why we can do this. This kind of thing, this X is a standard model singlet. It carries PQ charge, which allows us to write this coupling. But it's SU5, an SU5 singlet, which is, and this guy effectively would lift all of them. Yeah? Yeah, I would put that at, I would maybe put that as zero, and that is not engineer single stack models. So I mean, that's of course another option, but then you have to start it, you know. Yeah. So that would be item zero. So that's one thing I left off the list. This is good. I was hoping if I left things off the list, people would speak up and tell me. Good. That's one thing. Hopefully that's all. So then there's this other thing that people know, and that's exotic. You know, probably a lot of people in this room know this, and that exotics are not the only potential problem with these models. And I meant to put problem in quotation marks here, as it really deserves quotation marks. That is this. Well, we first learned from Ralph in December 2008, I think, right? There's a unification problem in models that use hypercharged flux. And one simple way to understand that is look at this eight-dimensional gauge theory I'm talking about. Compactify it down to four dimensions, and you have some Kaluza-Klein spectrum. Now integrate all the Kaluza-Klein modes out. Well, Lanaghi and Weinhold essentially did this. And you can see very clearly that there's a one-loop divergence. And that one-loop divergence generates an operator like this with a logarithmic divergence sitting in front of it. And I put the separate citation to Weinhold here to remind me to specify that we learned a lot about the details of this from Martin at a talk in Munich. And he was very nice to communicate with us, share some notes with us, and so on, so we could really learn what was going on. So, I mean, this is a very explicit calculation that Martin and Ron did, where you just, you know, KK expand, you know, integrate everything out, you get some Ray-Singer torsions, and these Ray-Singer torsions, you can use the scaling behavior to isolate the divergent piece and see that the divergences don't all cancel. You get something like this generated in your theory. And this is bad. Now, first of all, you would say, how the heck can this be happening? I have a divergence, but string theory is supposed to be a finite theory. You know, what happened? And then you read the papers by Joe Conlon, which talk about exactly this kind of thing in a kind of different context, and that is that this gauge theory is only part of the physics, so there must be something else that's canceling this local tadpole globally in the string compactification. So this divergence will get cut off, but it'll get cut off by a scale associated with the perpendicular direction to the gut divisor. So. And the important point is that this will be something non-zero, some ratio of scales, ratio of some larger, some higher scale to the Kaluza-Klein scale. Now, this operator is problematic, as Ralph pointed out, because if you plug in background hypercharge flux here and here and integrate over the internal manifold, then this leads to this thing will give, non-trivial contributions to the gauge kinetic functions. So in particular, this leads to distortions of the four decouplings at the KK scale that sort of look like this, with some log of lambda over MKK, where lambda is now the scale at which everything's being cut off that Joe calls the winding scale, and MKK is some Kaluza-Klein scale. These are non-universal shifts. They split the gauge couplings at the high scale. So you can wonder what they do to unification. Well, you should really ask, what do they do about our ability to be consistent with the fact that we know what the measured couplings are at the low scale? And before I get into this slide, I'm going to preface everything by saying that I'm not an expert in precision unification. Everything I'm going to talk about here is just simple one loop, because I wanted to get an idea of just what's going on. So what we actually measure is this kind of thing, and this is saying that in addition to this guy, which is MSSM running from the Kaluza-Klein scale down, there's another threshold correction representing this divergence running from the Kaluza-Klein, or that happens at the Kaluza-Klein scale and gets cut off by something that's higher. This is not really gauge theory running, but it nicely enters in the same way as gauge theory running, so we can start to compare. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the answer I would give to that, the thing that I can say for sure about that, let me just say something sharp. And the sharp thing is you can actually compute what this divergence is and just see explicitly that it's logarithmic.
I thought that Weihoff was saying in Munich that in principle there could have been power corrections.
Mm-hmm.
They just said those zero.
Oh, I don't know that they said anything. Okay, maybe they did. I don't think so. I know that when I worked through this calculation when he sent this stuff to us, it seemed that you were only getting logarithmic divergences. But I don't want to say anything wrong, so I'll say I don't know.
Okay.
Somebody else knows. They can speak up. Okay. Okay, good. So the split. So the way to really see how well we're doing is to look at these splittings. So if you look at these splittings, of course the factor of alpha gut drops out, but we'll see have some sensitivity to these threshold corrections. And there's a question of, you know how good do we do, given some reasonable estimate for what this lambda over MKK is? Well, I think a good way to compare and see how well we're doing is compare to how you do without this thing. With the MSSM alone, the agreement with experimental values is within 0.5%, which is pretty good. So to me, if this thing is making the agreement worse than 0.5%, then we have some tension. And now you can try to estimate what this lambda is, and we estimate it by assuming that it's basically the scale set by the perpendicular direction of the brain in units of the seven brain tension. And if you do that, this lambda over MKK has to be somewhere between around 20 or 200 or something like that. And if you included this correction, that puts you right on the threshold of acceptability. If you want this, if you want these guys to agree with the MSSM to within 0.5%, then this thing needs to be less than on the order of 40. And we're saying that our estimates for it are somewhere between 17 and 200. So the reason I'm mentioning this is just to specify that in the absence of anything else, there is a tension. Now, this is a tension at the level of where order one coefficients, you know, God knows what could be happening. So it's not a problem per se. It's a quote-unquote problem. But it's something where there is some, in principle, some tension when these threshold corrections come in. Yeah. Okay. Well. Okay. Well, that would be good. Again, this is just one loop to get an idea of whether these things are bad or not. And the point is that you can't really distinguish whether they're really bad or whether they're not bad at all. So we're sitting sort of on a boundary. So the only sharp statement I want to make is there is potentially some tension, and maybe this makes it less tension. I don't know. The thing is, I don't think we know this well enough that we can really say anything, you know, that high precision study of unification will do us any good. Because the uncertainty in this, the uncertainty in this is so much that even this kind of analysis is not so good. But the question I really had was whether that this was so bad that you had a serious problem you had to deal with. And the statement is, I don't think it's so serious, but there's possibly some tension. I think that's a safe statement to make. I see. Well, I haven't actually computed what the percent correction this is. Yes. Is it sensitive? How sensitive is that? I see. Okay. Yes. Right. I actually haven't. Yeah, yeah. As you know, I haven't checked the sign of this, unfortunately. There's an extra contribution here that wasn't in the 2B calculation. I don't know if it changes the sign or not, but I suspect it doesn't. So you're probably, thanks. Yeah. Okay, good. So there's some potentially some tension, that's all I want to say. But I'm trying to be very detailed about what we're saying and what we're not so that it's very clear. I don't want to make any claims that are not correct. And then if we take these exotic fields that were forced on us from PQ, from this PQ business, so all this was without those, and you take them seriously and you throw them in, you see they're also going to give contributions, and you can ask, well, you know, how significant are these? And depending on your perspective, you can say, oh, these exotics are nice because they open up a larger parameter space where you can try to find better agreement because you have another parameter to tune. And you can try to estimate how big these exotic masses have to be so that this whole story remains muddled within this few percent business and it's not, you know, obviously horrible. And the statement is that these exotic fields need to be bigger than on the order of 10 to the 13th to 14 GeV. And if they're bigger than on the order of 10 to the 13, 14 GeV, then you start needing this lambda scale to get big. And by the way, there's an upper bound on this lambda scale. We're always assuming it's smaller than the Planck scale because we expect that whatever these global tadpoles are, they're being canceled by something that's coming in before the Planck scale. So these terms are all honest gauge theoretic running.
Sure.
This guy actually incorporates all of the modes of the eight-dimensional gauge theory. So these contributions are sort of included in the divergence that you calculate here. And I should also stress that this is really not honest gauge theory running, four-dimensional gauge theory running. It's a logarithmic divergence, so it looks the same. And it gets cut off somewhere, so you can throw it in here as though it looks like you're running up the scale lambda, but you're not really. This thing automatically contains all of the modes of the theory. In fact, in order to get the nice form for the divergence, you have to sort of, in order to get the nice form of the divergence, you have to realize that. Because when you calculate the divergence, there's some extra things, the Betti numbers that show up. And you realize the Betti numbers that show up are basically these contributions. So, those made it seem like there was some very, very, but in the end, all those things go away, and you're left with something that looks fairly universal. I should mention these are precisely the beta function running. These are precisely the beta function coefficients of Lepdoe quarks, so the same ones that you would get from Lepdoe quarks. So this is trace adjoint f to the fourth, which contains trace fundamental f to the fourth minus basically trace f squared squared. That's all. Good. Basically, what it amounts to is computing the relative coefficients. So this splitting depends on which gauge coupling you're talking about, and you compute the relative coefficients. And the relative coefficients are these, and I write them as beta i's. That's all. Yeah, it's exactly the same thing you did, except in the case of this. And there's nothing, I'm not claiming to dive anything deep. So. That's all I want to say about that. Our two problems, to the extent they are problems, maybe they're not, but to the extent that they are, they may be able to cancel each other. Yep. Yeah, please.
So that's
right. Good. So you have to go in, and this is something you have to be careful about. You have to reanalyze whether vevving up the scalar field starts generating these proton decay operators. And actually, we found that it's kind of tough to, if you had infinite freedom over the U1 charges, you could arrange for it to happen. You could arrange for this to work. However, you don't have an infinite control over it because everything is coming from E8. And we found, I think, that the only setting in which you can give this guy a VEV and still consistently keep the proton decay operators forbidden is one where you actually have two U1 symmetries and not one. And there's a question about whether such models are fiction or not. Because no semi-local models with consistent Higgs bundles have been constructed that preserve two U1 symmetries. I think you should be able to do it, but it hasn't been done. So, did that answer your question? In the semi-local model we wrote last December, if you vev up the scalar, there are a couple issues with that. If you vev up the scalar field, it gives masses to the exotics. I'm going to forget the sharp statement. I actually don't remember whether you regenerate these proton decay operators there or not, but one thing's for sure, you break matter parity. So if you like matter parity, you need to do something different. So if you want to keep all of it.
Mm-hmm.
No, there's no nodal theorem. Yeah, in principle. Yeah, that's the question. Basically, we don't know. We have not. There's a question of whether, you know, how easily you can construct these semi-local models of preserved 2U ones. And I say, the only reason I said I don't know if you can do it is because I haven't done it. I don't like to claim. Yeah. So, but maybe, yeah, I don't see any obvious instructions, so it should be possible to do it. It's just, you know, a pain. You know, the problem there is that when you start factoring the spectral cover, all these B coefficients, they start having many common factors. And you run into problems where generically you'll have points where all of them vanish. And you run into this issue, this thing Tyson was talking about in his talk, where the, you know, entire bundle collapses and, you know, Dave Morrison tells you have tensionless strings and this is bad. So that's the thing you have to watch out for. And there's a question of whether you can get around that. Okay, so to make progress, it's important. So everything I've said so far is about the charge sector, just describing the SU5 degrees of freedom. To make progress, we really want to move past the charge sector. Why is it important to move past the charge sector? Well, first of all, right-handed neutrinos are SU5 singlets. So, you know, those are SU5 singlet fields. Exotic masses come from coupling to SU5 singlets. And Suzy breaking spurions, if you want to include them, will also be SU5 singlets. And these singlets are distinguished because they localize on curves that do not sit in the same, you know, on the same divisor as the SU5 gut brains. They localize on curves that can explore the geometry away from the gut brains. So they're not necessarily captured by this gauge theory picture. They probe the geometry away from the gut brains, so the gauge theory perspective may not be useful, and maybe we cannot rely so strongly on heterotic input. So it's very important to move beyond the charge sector, and one of the first things to do that is to talk about fluxes. And I think this is something that Ralph probably mentioned at the open of the S-Fino workshop. The fluxes, this is kind of the elephant in the room, and that is that the fluxes that induce chirality are essentially constructed through heterotic techniques. And what we basically do is you take your F-theory geometry locally near the SU5 gut surface, where you have a good gauge theory description. It looks like it's K3 fibered. So you pull it out of your geometry and glue it into something that's globally K3 fibered. You construct all your fluxes using heterotic techniques. You look how those fluxes look in the local geometry and then excise it and put it back. And you assume that the fluxes all come along for the ride when you put it back. But nobody says that the fluxes you built with heterotic techniques extend globally to well-defined objects. So what we really need to get around this is an intrinsic F-theory understanding of global fluxes. And I think without this, it's impossible to really start saying detailed things about physics away from the gut brain. So we have some ideas for this, and hopefully something about this will appear soon. But this is really the elephant in the room. And finally, let me just conclude by saying some things about compact models. There are people a lot of times ask what's the status of compact model building. And modulo these flux assumptions, there are several compact models. There's two groups building them. There's our group, and then there's Ralph's group, most of, I think all of whom were here at some point for the workshop. In fact, all of these people minus me were here for the F-theory focus week, if I understand correctly. So, but I think everyone would agree that these are sort of toy models at best. Moduli stabilization is not yet addressed in either of these frameworks. And in known examples, the D3 tadpole condition doesn't leave a whole lot of room for the fluxes that you would need to do this. So in order to cancel the D3 tadpole, you have to add a number of D3 brains that specify by, well, the older character of the fourfold, suitably defined, and the G fluxes, which induce a three-brain charge. And the problem is this contribution is negative semi-definite, which means as you turn on more and more fluxes, you make it more and more likely that you need to add a negative number of D3 brains. Of course, adding a negative number of D3 brains is adding anti-D3 brains and breaking supersymmetry in a possibly uncontrolled way. Now, maybe if you want, you add anti-D3 brains and put them at the tip of some warp throat or something. This is a very popular idea, but I know nothing about this. I don't know very much about this, so I don't want to comment on this possibility. If you're interested in constructing supersymmetric vacua, you really need to be careful. You can't turn on so many G-fluxes. And I know in our models, and I think also in Ralph's, this constraint that you don't overshoot wiped out almost all the possibilities. Well, at least I'll say for us, I know it wiped out almost all the possibilities. And the amount by which you missed the overshoot was small enough that it seems like if you turn on any other fluxes from Bosch stabilizing moduli, you're going to be doomed. Another comment that is very nice, it seems that heterotic formulae can be used to compute this G wedge G. In certain favorable situations, we only have one non-abelian gauge group. This is quite interesting, because when you don't have a heterotic dual, it's saying that there's something really good about using heterotic data to construct these G fluxes, because they do give, they do seem to give the right answer in a number of favorable situations, even when a heterotic dual doesn't exist. So with those comments, I'll just put up my summary slide, and I'm basically out of time, so I'll stop there. Thanks very much.